Susan Yaffe with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, Gulf states are to target Hezbollah.
Hezbollah has entered into Syria in a very serious manner, and this is causing a ripple effect across the region.
U.S. and Russia are cautiously optimistic about Iran's newly elected president. Ethiopia and Egypt are trying to ease Nile tensions. And entertainer Barbara Streisand wades into one of Israel's touchiest issues. It's all ahead. Leaders from the Group of Eight Nations are calling for a negotiated end to the two-year Syrian conflict, but stop short of demanding the ouster of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The heads of state of key world economic powers said Tuesday peace talks should be convened as soon as possible. U.S. President Barack Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin disagree on how they want the bloodshed in Syria to be resolved, but both say they want it resolved through negotiations. The two leaders met on the sidelines of the Group of Eight summit in Northern Ireland. After their two-hour meeting, Presidents Obama and Putin emphasized that their fundamental positions on Syria have not changed. Mr. Putin continues to support the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, citing stability concerns, while Mr. Obama insists that no political settlement can include President Assad. But the U.S. and Russian leaders said proposed talks in Geneva are necessary for a resolution. Mr. Putin spoke through an interpreter.
And of course our opinions do not coincide, but all of us have the intention to stop the violence in Syria, to stop the growth of victims, and to solve this, the situation peacefully, including by bringing the parties to the negotiations table in Geneva. We agreed to push the parties to the negotiations table.
Mr. Obama thanked the Russian president for what he called a useful conversation. He agreed that their opinions on Syria do not coincide, but he said both sides share an interest in stopping the violence and the use and spread of chemical weapons.
We do have differing perspectives on the problem, but we share an interest in reducing the violence, securing chemical weapons, and ensuring that they're neither used nor are they subject to proliferation. And that we want to try to resolve the issue through political means if possible. And so we have instructed our team to continue to work on the potential of a Geneva follow-up.
The U.S. ambassador to NATO tells Reuters that neither the alliance nor the United States is considering a no-fly zone over Syria at this time. However, the White House has not ruled it out completely. Russia warns it would not permit enforced restrictions on Syrian airspace. We asked David Butter of the think tank Chatham House his reaction to the idea of possibly putting a no-fly zone over Syria.
Well, there's been a lot of speculation about how that might happen ever since the Syrian regime started using its air force back in last year. Clearly, it wouldn't have any UN Security Council sanction, but I guess there's a precedent of that in the Bosnian conflict. In practice, some ideas have been put forward, for example, by John McCain, which appear to suggest that this will be kind of over the horizon, which one would assume would be a combination of cruise missile attacks on air defense and airfields, and perhaps aircraft operating from other countries' airspace, possibly Jordan, or possibly in the Mediterranean, targeting Syrian aircraft. So, you know, I guess technically there would be ways of doing this without actually physically sending aircraft or pilots into Syrian airspace.
Do you think the nations around Syria would put up with that?
Well, some of them would be hesitant to approve that. I'm not sure whether Turkey would be keen on that, but it may well do, given its hostility to the Assad regime. Israel, I think, would probably, you know, may even be involved in that, but would probably keep out, as it has its own sets of priorities in Syria. Lebanon clearly would not be keen on that, nor would Iraq. But I think there certainly is a possibility of Jordan going along with this, and perhaps even also Saudi Arabia, which is you know, probably close enough in terms of the technology of aircraft these days to take part as well.
After the success with the no-fly zone in Libya, why are nations hesitant to want to go ahead with the no-fly zone over Syria?
Well, there is a big difference here, of course, is that the no-fly zone in Libya came after a UN Security Council resolution that did give some sort of international legal cover to the operation that ensued. There was also the arguments made that Libya was perhaps an easier target. There's comparisons made between the quality of the air defense in Libya as compared with Syria, although, you know, some would say that the Syrian capabilities have been exaggerated. Also, I think in the Libyan case, you had the availability of NATO bases quite close in Italy in particular, which could be used for these operations. Whereas unless you really committed Turkey, you know, wholeheartedly to this operation as part of NATO, you wouldn't have that. And I get the feeling that Turkey might be reluctant to sort of sticking its neck out in this sense because of its need to consider its relations with Russia and Iran.
Do you think any part of this is because the rebels are so diverse, there are so many different types of rebels, and there's fear that perhaps the wrong group will get in charge?
Dealing with or supporting the rebels has been a very difficult political sell all the way through, whether you're talking about the rebels fighting on the ground or the opposition political group, because they do not present a unified and coherent entity that the West feels comfortable working with. And clearly the rebels also include elements who, from their track record, could well turn against the West at some future date and are not primarily motivated by trying to sort of create a stable and democratic Syria. So, there are all sorts of reasons why, steering well clear of this conflict is a good counsel. But, then again, there is the other side of the coin, the old doctrine of responsibility to protect in a situation of major slaughter by a regime of its own people.
David Butter, an associate fellow at Chatham House in London. Gulf Arab states are preparing to launch a series of measures against Hezbollah's interests in the region. The move is in retaliation for the Lebanese Shiite militant group's growing military involvement in Syria. Philip Walter Wellman reports from Dubai.
The Gulf Cooperation Council, which includes Sunni-ruled Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Bahrain, and Oman, recently announced it would begin imposing sanctions against Hezbollah associates. Officials say the measures will target suspected affiliates' residency permits and financial and commercial dealings. The action comes after Hezbollah sent forces to Syria, which played a major role in helping pro-government forces recapture the strategic town of Qusair. Theodore Karasik is the Director of Research and Development at the Dubai-based Institute for Near East and Gulf Military Analysis.
Hezbollah has entered into Syria in a very serious manner, and this is causing a ripple effect across the region where there may be sympathizers for Hezbollah's movement. And I think that the GCC is attempting to show that whose side that they're really on.
Most Muslim states, including those in the Gulf, have traditionally approved of Hezbollah as a bulwark against Israel, despite regarding it as an Iranian proxy. The group's increasing involvement in Syria, however, has shifted sentiments and has intensified the rift between Sunnis and Shiites. A Shiite Muslim offshoot dominates Syria's government, and Shiite Muslims constitute a majority in Iran. Last week, Muslim clerics representing 70 influential Sunni organizations called for a holy war against Assad and his Shiite allies. Saudi Arabia and Qatar, which have both used their oil fortunes to gain political influence in the region, are among the strongest critics of Hezbollah's military intervention in Syria. According to Michael Stevens, a researcher at RUSI Qatar, their opposition stems in part from concerns that the GCC is in a less commanding position.
I think what we see is there is just an existential fear of Iran gaining in the region and of the Gulf states having put a lot of money, time, weapons, and diplomatic effort behind one side of the Syrian conflict, only to see the Shia forces within the region mobilizing and starting to beat them back.
Analysts say Gulf nations are also using the Syria conflict as a way to clamp down on sources of dissent at home.
Bahrain!
Bahrain's Sunni rulers have been dealing with a pro-reform uprising led by the nation's Shiite majority since 2011. Bahrain accuses Hezbollah of backing and training radical gangs inside the kingdom, a claim Hezbollah denies. In a televised address Friday, Hezbollah's leader Hassan Nasrallah announced that his troops would continue fighting in Syria. And according to analyst Karasik in Dubai, the GCC is preparing itself for any eventuality.
If the current trajectory holds, which is very difficult to ascertain because it can go in a number of different directions, I would suspect that there'll be a further divide between the Sunni and the Shiite states and their supporters in the region, and that's going to have a massive spillover effects on neighboring countries. So what the GCC states are doing now is what they do best together, which is defense and homeland security.
Gulf officials have signaled that when it comes to Hezbollah, nothing is being ruled out. Philip Walter Wellman for VOA News, Dubai.
Egypt has further aligned itself with those trying to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But VOA's Elizabeth Ehret reports from Cairo, it remains unclear how far Egypt will back its words with action.
Syria's civil war has increasingly drawn in outsiders, from individual fighters to regional and international powers lining up on opposing sides. Egypt has recently stepped up its role, but the message appears mixed. President Mohamed Morsi has severed Egypt's already tenuous ties with Syria's government, a move denounced by Syrian officials as influenced by the United States and Israel. Mr. Morsi also lashed out at intervention by Lebanon's Hezbollah fighters on the side of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Speaking at a rally Saturday, he said Hezbollah must leave, adding there is no space or place for Hezbollah in Syria. The open presence of the Shiite militant group in Syria has highlighted the conflict's increasingly sectarian nature. Leading Sunni clerics meeting in Cairo last week denounced the presence of those they call rejectionists, and influential Egyptian Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi urged Sunnis to wage jihad in Syria. An aide to Mr. Morsi said that Egyptians are free to fight in Syria, but not all Islamist politicians in this predominantly Sunni country agree that jihad is the answer. Mohamed Sudan is Foreign Secretary of the Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party.
They want to save the souls of the Muslims, but you should know that the other side also are Muslims. Then Muslims are killing each other.
Yet President Morsi gave a stark warning. He said the Syrian people are facing a campaign of extermination and planned ethnic cleansing, which he argued was fed by regional and international states who do not care for the Syrian citizen. It was a reference widely perceived to include Shiite Iran and the Syrian government's backers in Moscow, which raised questions about Mr. Morsi's call for a United Nations-backed no-fly zone. Veto-wielding Russia has made clear it would block such a move. Mr. Morsi, facing growing opposition at home, including planned demonstrations at the end of the month, has shifted his government's focus to international events in recent weeks, now with Syria, earlier with Ethiopia and its controversial dam project on the Nile. But in his speech at the rally, the Egyptian leader gave no indication his government would send arms, let alone military personnel, to Syria, calling instead for talks. The FJP's Mohamed Sudan.
The solution is to sit down. We should force Iran to let the Bashar to sit down to see that he can save exit with his people and to save the Syrian people, not to escalate the war. We will lose more and more souls from both sides.
Calls for negotiations are almost as old as the war itself, now in its third year. Meanwhile, the rhetoric and acts of sectarianism grow, while solutions remain in short supply. Elizabeth Thau at VOA News, Cairo.
A lack of funding is forcing United Nations agencies helping in Lebanon to cut back on assisting Syrian refugees. Medical subsidies and food assistance are to be reduced. Meanwhile, there are reports that Lebanese hospitals and shops contracted by the UN are profiteering. Jamie Detmer has details from Beirut.
500,000 Syrians have registered so far in Lebanon as refugees, and relief agencies are fast running out of funds. Lebanon does not have refugee camps, with most Syrian refugees living in rented accommodation, while some live with friends and relatives. The UN says the refugees live in makeshift accommodations in 1,400 towns across Lebanon. Despite the large number of Syrian refugees, only 26% of the UN's needed funding in Lebanon has arrived. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees is having to cut back on subsidizing medical care. Dana Sliman of the UN's Refugee Agency.
We have had to make a very painful choice of reducing the healthcare services to refugees from 85% to 75% of life-saving operations only, and many refugees are finding it very, very expensive to cover the 25%. So we're doing our best to refer them to other agencies that are on the ground also working, doing their best to fill this gap.
But there are reports from refugees that hospitals have been overcharging when they know the care is being paid for by the UN. One invoice seen by VOA for an appendix operation at a Beirut public hospital showed the UN being charged $1,000 for the surgery and the Syrian patient $400. The average cost for the surgery is about $500. The UN Sliman acknowledges there are problems.
It's true that in many instances, a few instances, let's say, we have seen reports of people telling us, but we're charged more than we're supposed to. These reports we take extremely seriously. We follow up on these reports. It's a very big operation. We have to, we have to have faith at the end of the day.
But Rabbi Bana of the Jesuit Refugee Service says profiteering off international donors is widespread.
They're being overcharged. Like, they charge the UN more or less, which is, like, happening in many hospitals in Bekaa, in the Rafir Hariri Hospital in Beirut.
Syrian refugees and aid workers say shop owners are also taking advantage. The UN's World Food Programme has been giving each registered refugee $31 worth of food coupons a month, an amount that will be reduced to $27 in coming weeks, partly because of a budgetary squeeze. The vouchers can be used at shops that have contracted with the UN, but store owners raise the prices for goods when they're used. WFP's William Barakat says the agency is trying to curb the corruption.
There is misuse among the contracted shops, WFP shops, all over Lebanon, and particularly in the Bekaa, and we are monitoring our shops. So, and whenever we identify similar cases, we warn the shops, and after that, we cancel the contract.
Barakat says seven stores in the Bekaa Valley recently lost their contracts. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Beirut.
During their talks Monday in Northern Ireland, President Obama said he and his Russian counterpart are cautiously optimistic that Iran's newly elected president will push for progress in nuclear talks. Mr. Obama said the two leaders hope it will be possible to generate dialogue on Iran's controversial nuclear program in light of the election of moderate cleric Hassan Rouhani. Mr. Rouhani said Monday Iran wants to prove its nuclear work fully meets international standards. The United States and its Western allies suspect Iran of trying to build nuclear weapons and have helped to implement several rounds of sanctions against Iran that have battered the country's economy. Iran says its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes only. William Hague, the British Foreign Secretary, spoke about the issue before Parliament.
The government hopes that following Dr. Rouhani's election, the Iranian government will take up the opportunity of a new relationship with the international community by making every effort to reach a negotiated settlement on the nuclear issue. If Iran is prepared to make that choice, we are ready to respond in good faith. So I urge Iran to engage seriously with the E3+3 and urgently to take concrete steps to address international concerns. Iran should not doubt our resolve to prevent nuclear proliferation in the Middle East and to increase the pressure through international sanctions should its leaders choose not to take this path.
Jen Psaki is a U.S. State Department spokesperson in Washington.
There are a number of steps that the leadership in Iran needs to take in order to abide by their international obligations. The P5 plus one is ready to meet with Iran when Iran is ready to respond substantively to the balanced proposal put forward by the P5 plus one in Almaty. We haven't seen a substantive response yet. The reason there are a number of promises that were made during this election. The question is what happens moving forward, and we will see. But as you know, the Supreme Leader holds the nuclear portfolio, the leadership, we have not had expectations leading up to this election that would change.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki. Egypt and Ethiopia are taking steps to defuse tensions over Ethiopia's diversion of the Nile River to construct a massive hydroelectric dam. But as Martha Vandervoel reports from Addis Ababa, Egypt has not apologized to Ethiopia for the harsh language used in recent weeks.
The ministers of foreign affairs from Egypt and Ethiopia held talks in Addis Ababa on Monday and Tuesday morning. At issue, the tensions that rose after Ethiopia began diverting part of the Blue Nile to advance construction of the Great Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Ethiopian Foreign Minister Tedros Adhanom told reporters in Addis Ababa Tuesday that both nations have agreed to implement recommendations made by an international panel of experts and to hold further talks.
Both ministers, in a spirit of brotherly relations and mutual understanding, agreed to embark on consultations at the technical and political levels with the participation of the Republic of Sudan to implement in a speedy manner the International Panel of Experts' recommendations.
The diplomatic language is a far cry from the heated exchanges over the $5 billion dam, which Egypt fears will threaten its vital water supply. Most Nile River water originates in Ethiopia. However, colonial-era treaties written by Britain gave Egypt as much as 87% of the Nile's flow. Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi has gone so far as to warn this month that all options were open in terms of his country's response to the dam project. The high-level talks come after Ethiopia last week became the sixth country to back replacing colonial-era treaties with a new commission to oversee Nile projects. Rwanda, Burundi, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda have already signed the agreement. Egypt is among several nations that have yet to do so. Despite the calmer language, Egyptian Foreign Minister Mohamed Kamel Amer says his country need not apologize for some of its politicians who suggested the right course of action may be to sabotage the construction of the dam.
It's not a matter of regrets or apologies. Well, some pronouncements were made in the heat of the moment or because of the emotions, so no regrets were required.
Minister Tedros is expected to travel to Cairo soon to continue talks over the dam's possible impact. Ethiopian officials argue Egypt can make up any reduction with better water management. The construction of the dam started 2 years ago and is about 20% done. When completed in 2017, it will transform Ethiopia into Africa's biggest producer of electricity. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
American entertainer Barbara Streisand waded into one of Israel's touchiest issues Monday on the first major stop of her tour of the country. The issue? Jewish religious practices that separate men and women. Speaking at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, where she received an honorary doctorate, she took aim at cases of ultra-Orthodox Jews targeting women, even as she warmly praised the country.
It's distressing to read about women in Israel being forced to sit in the back of a bus, or when we hear about women of the wall having metal chairs hurled at them when they attempt to peacefully and legally pray, or women being banned from singing in public ceremonies. But I'm also pleased to read that things are changing here. Repairs are slowly being made, and that's very good. I don't pretend to know all the historical, legal, or cultural details, and I know that solutions don't come easy, as they don't in the United States, where women are still making 80 cents for every dollar that a man makes. But to remain silent about these things is tantamount to accepting them. So I continue to ask why.
Entertainer Barbara Streisand. This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.